Hi, good evening, everybody. Welcome. Tonight's share is sadly on Megillas Echa and also Parshas Devarim. Wanted to just try to briefly touch upon Devarim first and then do a quick dive into Echa. It's not enough time for me, but at least we can touch on some points. The first is that with Devarim, I wanted to highlight something that most people don't typically highlight. I saw it in a sefer by my former Chavrusa when I was 19 and years old learning in Eretz Yisrael, and my Chavrusa at the time, Moshe Kakutsky, put together a sefer, and he took a midvash, which is translated sweeter than honey, and he asked the question about Og Melech HaBashan. We don't really talk about him much, but he had a very interesting background, so I just want to touch on him for a quick second or two. We know that Og was one of the people that actually held on to the Teva, the Medrash tells us, during the Mabul. For 40 days and 40 nights, he was holding on outside of the Teva. And his brother Sichon, according to the Medrash, was conceived on the Teva by Cham, which was a transgression because when the world is being destroyed, there is no time for cohabitation. But that was one of the punishments that Cham ended up suffering from, as we'll see, through the generations. But when Moshe Rabbeinu has to face off against Og, he's terrified. Why? Why is he afraid of Og? So one explanation is quite rational. He's very old. He's been around forever. And the second explanation is that Og was a giant, and he was literally larger than life. They say that Moshe was roughly 10 feet tall. Moshe's staff was roughly 10 feet, and he jumped 10 feet and he hit Og on the heel, which means that Og was a tremendous, colossal giant. So Moshe feared Og, but Hashem says, "Don't worry about him. Don't be afraid. Al tisyareh mehem. Don't be afraid of them. Don't be afraid of Og." This is the only time in the whole parsha. This is the only time in the whole Torah where you find that Hashem specifically commands Moshe not to be afraid, because he will be handed over to his hand. But the question is, what is it? What schus did Og have that allowed Moshe to consider being afraid? And just to go pull the onion back another layer, so to speak. We know that Og was the palit. He was a messenger that delivered terrible news to Sarah that that caused her to have a heart attack. He asked her, "Where is this knife that you normally have in the kitchen? Where is your son Yitzchak? And where's your husband? And where's Yishmael?" So she started to put one and one together and realizing that if Yitzchak is gone, then her life is gone. And so therefore, it was very difficult for her to manage this and she passed away from being overwhelmed. But Og's desire there was actually to marry Sarah, the Medrash says. It's a very, strange way of him communicating this message, but that was his ulterior motive. But the reason why he had this fear factor with Moshe is because when it came to the situation where Lot was taken captive in Sodom, Avram went to war and to free his nephew. The one of the people that fought alongside Og and fought alongside Avraham Avinu was Og. And he ended up killing Kedorlaomer. So that was a very big moment in history because once he killed Kedorlaomer, the war basically came to an end. Kedorlaomer, interestingly, was one of the descendants of Shem ben Noach. And when Melchizedek later comes out and brings him bread and wine, there are two reasons, there's actually three. The first reason is because bread and wine was a way of replenishing strength. And second is because it was a reconciliation of terms that Avraham Avinu said, "I didn't mean that Kedorlaomer should be killed, but he was fighting against me. And this is what happens in war." So there was a reconciliation. So because Og did this one act of chesed, he merited to have this tremendous chus in his pocket. And that's what Moshe was afraid of, because he did one act to the current day and age. We have, by the when we actually let me go back one step. The pasuk says, "V'yisha'er ach Noach," that there was a remnant, only Noach. But the Das HaKinan brings down that the word ach aleph chaf is 21, and Noach nun ches is 58. So if you add 21 and 58, you get 79. And Og is spelled out ayin vav gimel. 70 plus 6 plus 3, 79. So the one that was the remnant of the Teva was Og Melech HaBashan. I meant to say this that, you know, maybe 2 minutes ago. But when we come back full circle, we see how one act of chesed changed the course of Moshe's perception of who Og was. He had a colorful background for sure. He had things in his, and you know, he definitely was not a friend of the Jewish people, but he did an act of chesed for our ancestor Avraham Avinu. And that's what merited him to have that unique schus. So I just wanted to highlight that we don't understand the true benefit when we do one act of a gemilas chesed. It could be so powerful, like we learn in Parshas Ekev, where David HaMelech was not worried about the big mitzvos that he wasn't going to complete. He was going to do them. He was worried about the small ones, such as counting Sfira, making a bracha rishona, bracha achrona. Maybe those things were dash ba'akav, like pushed aside with your heel, and you don't really pay too close attention to it. So I wanted to just impress upon everybody listening how important it is to do an act of chesed and how that can really change the world. The recipient, obviously, is a tremendous benefactor. And of course, the one who's providing the chesed, whether it's outlaying money or whether it's giving time, a listening ear, and all sorts of forms of encouragement, positive reinforcement. We have no idea how this can help a person steady the course and how that stands as a testament for that person in good stead. So that's point number one. Point number two is that when we think about Devarim, we open up by saying that there are so many issues with the Jewish people in different places, but because of the honor that the Jewish people have, and because we are Rachmanim Bashanim and Gomle Chasadim, because we are merciful, because we are easily embarrassed when we do something incorrect, and because we are inherently those people, like we just mentioned, that perform good acts for others, and we provide kindness to other people, when we make an infraction, it really hurts us, and it's something that we can't reconcile so easily. That's the reason why the opening of the parsha of Devarim begins, Bein Lavan, Bein Tofel, Dizahav. Dizahav refers to Egel Azav, and the Midbar refers to where they saw the when they were about to go into the water, they complained to Moshe. There were a lot of complaints. And then I think the question is, how do we go about giving people rebuke if we're not able to do it directly? In fact, the Chafetz Chaim brings down that no one can do it today because anyone who's giving any form of rebuke is not going to be listened to. Why? Because it may not be coming from a sincere place. And the person who's receiving the rebuke may not be able to swallow it. Difficult pill to listen to someone tell you that you did something wrong. So maybe it has to come through the following way. And I'd like to try to close out with that thought. And then we'll touch upon Echa for just a brief second or two. That when we deliver a message to an individual, whether it's a family member or a close friend, we have to recognize that it has to come from love. Because the Pasuk says that first Yitzchak blessed Yaakov by Yevarech. Yitzchak is, I think the Pasuk, right before he sent them away by Tolos, and then he gave them a tzava, here's your tafkid, here's your mission, that is, you have to find a girl from your mother's family. And that was the mission. So when we do something, when we have to tell someone how to do things better, we have to really think about the presence and the circumstance and the environment where the person is. You have to bring a person over to your side in a private way, not in a public way. You have to do it, you know, by first giving a person a blessing, saying that you know better and I wanted to just bless you that you should do things right, you know, in the future and your family, you should be healthy. All these wonderful things you say over. And then you say, oh, by the way, you may not have noticed, but here's one thing that I may have observed. I may have done it incorrectly or seen it incorrectly or maybe not paid close attention. But, you know, this is a proper way to do things, and maybe that's the best way to communicate. Other than that, and even with that, it is very challenging. So I give everyone a big hartzaga yasher koach if they're able to deliver a message of some form of rebuke, but it has to, be done in a positive way. One quick story, the Chafetz Chaim, we all know the story. There was a boy in the neighborhood that was smoking cigarettes, and the Chafetz Chaim was brought before the Chafetz Chaim. He asked them, "Do you smoke?" He said, "Yes." "Do you know that smoking on Shabbos is not proper? It's not allowed. It's against halacha." He said, "Yes." He said, "Which hand do you smoke with?" He said, "My right." He held the hand and then he cried, "Shabbos, Shabbos, Shabbos." He said that word three times, and then, you know, with tears falling down his face, they singed the boy's hand, so to speak, and the boy promised never to smoke again on Shabbos because he did not want to upset the Rebbe. And when it comes through love, when it comes through tears, it makes a bigger impression than just simply telling someone off. And I actually have my own example of when someone was talking during Ne'ilah on Yom Kippur, and I told him to please be quiet, and the guy started yelling at me. "How could you talk to me? Who are you to tell me to be quiet?" So again, I learned my lesson. You know, there's a time and a place for everything. Even when you are in the right, it's very, very difficult to do things in the most proper way. So, I learned that maybe that wasn't even the best time to speak to somebody about it. Maybe after Yom Kippur would have been better for the future. Just one thought about Echa, because I have to just touch upon this briefly. We know that Echa was written by Yirmiyahu HaNavi. And first Rashi over here, there's a very fascinating, I would love to give a separate share on this, on Echa. So I'd like to talk with Mitch about giving a share about this maybe tomorrow night, maybe a different time, but some time to give it.
Echa, how about is, on Tisha B'Av?
Yeah, I'm off on Tisha B'Av.
The day is long. The day is long on Tisha B'Av day in the afternoon.
Okay, so you know what? My witching hour for me, the hardest part of my fast is 2 o'clock. So I'll volunteer to give the share at 2 o'clock, which is the hardest part of the fast time for me. And if I give it during that time, maybe my mind won't be thinking about everything.
All right, put it on the chat. Put it on the chat. We'll set it up. 2 o'clock. Sounds good.
Okay. So just briefly, we're going to get into it on 2 o'clock tomorrow, on Tuesday. There's a Gemara in Sanhedrin on Daf Kuf Dalet, which is what we'll talk about, where Yoyakim burned the names of Hashem throughout Echa because he was upset that he will no longer be king. And this is a tremendous blow because Yoyakim was not, even though the name is a beautiful name, he was not from the Tzaddikim. And we'll get into that a little bit deeper. So that's first teaser. The second is, why do we begin with Echa? So one refresh I was learning was that Echa is the Gematria 36. And there are 36 sins that are punishable by Kares, right? So, and the Klai Yisrael was in violation of all 36. And that's the Gematria. Echa is Chaf and Hey is 25. And then you have a Yud is 35 and an Aleph is 36. So that's how you get to 36. The second is that we find that in Echa, it follows the Aleph, Bey, is Gimel. Every Pasuk that follows Aleph, Echa Yashva Badad, Bachosuke Balaila, Galsi Yudu Me'oni, Darche Tziyon Avelus. I close out with this idea, and that is that, we violated the Torah, which is written in a language of Aleph, Bey. There's 22 letters, so every single one of the letters in the Torah felt itself being violated, which is a very interesting way. Like why we cover challah on Shabbos, because during the rest of the week, we always go into challah first. But here on Shabbos, we use a kos, so the kosher bracha gets precedence over the challah. So it just goes to show you that letters have feelings, and challah has feelings. And if we're sensitive to inanimate objects that we consume or that we simply view, then how much more so our fellow man? We should be that much more sensitive and understanding to the others. Even when we don't agree with them, we should still be able to have conversations with them. So that was the second point that I wanted to touch upon. And the last thing that I wanted to say is Bachosav Ke. We know that it says Bachosav Ke Balaila, the second Pasuk. Why does it say Bachosav Ke? So it's a double language. Yirmiyahu HaNavi saw that on the first temple being destroyed, something is not right, and therefore there's cause that the second will also be destroyed at the same time on Tisha B'Av. It's interesting, World War I also fell out on Tisha B'Av. I looked it up. July 28th? Some say it was August 1st or 2nd, but that is Tisha B'Av season because I went back to Hebkal. From World War I, obviously the Germans were upset with the Versailles Treaty, and that gave rise to World War II. But and all the problems that we have today really started with the greatest world war. But there's something over here, Bachosav Ke. The second explanation of Bachosav Ke is that if you cried one time, not for a good reason, because the spies came back and said that the land is not something that we can overcome, then there will be a crying. So it goes to show us that we have to be very careful, because our crying definitely has an impact on high. Why was it again that we cried at nighttime? Because that's when, and why is it? So the answer, first answer is that the Meraglim came back at night. And the second answer is that as a result, when the Beis Hamikdash was destroyed, the burning was at night. And that's the reason why we are so concerned even to this very day. So I think we'll try to go through the Rashis, which I think will be enough for us. I'll try to throw in maybe another Mefurash or two if I can. But Rashi and Eicha is robust. And I think that there's something. I'll close out with this one last thought. Promise. I'm like one of these guys that say, okay, one last thought, and then I have like 15 thoughts. But there is something to be said that when we talk about Rus and Esther, and we talk about happy Megillos, the question is, why are we talking about Eicha? No other religion has this. No other religion talks about our sad points. But we do. And when we come full circle about it, we are open to sometimes when we are not able to do things the proper way. But this gives us an opportunity to learn from prior shortcomings and to do things better in the future. I want to wish everyone an easy fast, and with hope that this is the last Tisha B'Av, that the circumstances on the ground should usher in the coming of Mashiach. We know that the Beis Hamikdash was destroyed by fire, and the Medrash brings down that it will be rebuilt with fire. I'm not sure exactly what that means, but when it does come down from Shemayim, or it's built over here first, I'm not sure which is going to happen first, but we should be Mesameach, and our sadness should be replaced with Yagon V'Simcha. But until that time, easy fast to everybody. Stay tuned for 2 o'clock on Tuesday afternoon, God willing, and have a great night.